The U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza continues for the 149th day, with the death toll exceeding 30,400, mostly women and children. Several Israeli forces are killed and their military equipment destroyed as Palestinian fighters carry out more retaliatory operations across Gaza. And a top Hamas official says talks are taking place in the Egyptian capital Cairo, with the hope of finalizing a ceasefire deal in Gaza. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The ongoing Israeli genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip keeps taking a heavy toll on civilians, with scores killed in the regime's attacks. At least 10 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike targeting a house in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza Strip. At least 11 civilians were also killed in an Israeli airstrike that targeted a tent for displaced people in Rafah. Dozens of civilians were killed in Israeli strikes on Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah in southern and central Gaza. For the second time in less than 48 hours, Israeli troops opened fire on Palestinians waiting for aid in Gaza City, killing one and injuring dozens. The death toll from Israel's onslaught on Gaza since early October has surpassed 30,400, most of them women and children. More than 71,000 others have been injured, while thousands more remain unaccounted for. Our correspondent Muti Abu Musaba says fresh Israeli attacks on Gaza have left behind more civilian casualties.
These days, the Palestinian people are witnessing another wave of the Israeli massacres hitting all areas of Gaza Strip. And the last night, the Palestinian people in Rafah City actually lived a horrifying night as the Israeli warplanes continued targeting more residential buildings. At least 14 Palestinian civilians, most of them women and children, were slaughtered while they were inside a house. When the Israeli warplanes destroyed that house over their heads. In the meantime, the Israeli occupation forces committed another massacre in Jabalia refugee camp by killing at least 10 Palestinian civilians. In As-Saftawi neighborhood located in the northern part of Gaza City also, the Israeli warplanes destroyed another house over the heads of the Palestinian residents there, killing at least 6 Palestinian civilians. And now, these moments, as we are speaking right now, the Israeli occupation forces are circumventing Hamad neighborhood located in the northern part of Khan Yunis City, knowing that the Israeli occupation forces committed an appalling massacre yesterday by attacking the school taking shelter there by the Palestinian evacuees.
Palestinian fighters are putting up stiff resistance to Israeli forces in Gaza as fighting on the ground rages on. The military wing of Hamas resistance movement said its fighters blew up a buoy-trapped house that resulted in death or injury of at least 7 regime soldiers. Al-Qassam Brigade said the group was also able to seize an Israeli Skylark drone in Gaza City. Israel confirmed the deaths of 3 soldiers in the Gaza Strip. It also said 14 others were injured, 6 of them seriously. The regime says 245 of its troops have been killed since it launched a ground invasion of Gaza in late October. Palestinian groups, however, say that the regime is intentionally hiding the real number of casualties among its forces in order to avoid public anger. The Islamic Jihad resistance movement has warned the Israeli Prime Minister over the regime's post-war scheme. The spokesman for the military wing of the Islamic Jihad said the future of the Gaza Strip will only be determined by the resistance movements, not Israel. Abu Hamza said the end of the war in Gaza will be the prelude to the complete destruction of the Israeli regime. He reiterated the group's readiness to continue the fight with Israel as long as it takes. The comments come as Israel plans to control and occupy Gaza after a possible truce there. Abu Hamza also called on Arabs and Muslims to provide Palestine with weapons. He urged all Palestinians to mobilize against Israel in the first day of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. A top Hamas official says the movement has received an invitation to visit Cairo for Gaza ceasefire talks that resume later on Sunday. Osama Hamdan says Hamas is keen to achieve a result that satisfies Palestinians. Hamdan says, however, that Israel does not want a ceasefire. He says the regime is killing Palestinians and the U.S. is giving it time to continue the crimes. Meanwhile, Egyptian sources say representatives of Hamas, Qatar, and the U.S. have arrived in Cairo to resume the talks. They say Palestinian and Israeli negotiators have already agreed on the duration of the ceasefire and a prisoner swap. Draft proposals indicate 400 Palestinian prisoners will be released in exchange for 40 Israeli captives. The proposals also include the daily delivery of 500 trucks of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, with both sides halting their military operations. However, the Israeli military withdrawal from the coastal strip remains a bone of contention. Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian teen in a violent raid near the Jalazun refugee camp, north of the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. According to Palestinian media, 13-year-old Mohammed Khalid Zaid died as a result of serious wounds that he sustained after being hit with the regime forces' live fire. Local sources said Israeli forces left the teen bleeding for about an hour before handing him over to Palestinian ambulance services. Another Palestinian teenager was also injured during the raid. Israel has intensified its incursions across the West Bank since launching a genocidal war in the Gaza Strip on October 7. Attacks by Israeli forces and settlers have left more than 400 Palestinians dead in the occupied territories since then. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Monica Ndil, earlier joined us with more details about the latest Israeli deadly raid in the occupied West Bank.
This teen was shot dead by the Israeli soldiers last night near Al-Jalazun refugee camp. We have to mention that there's the illegal settlement of Beit Il. It's adjacent to the refugee camp of Al-Jalazun. And the Israelis claim that this Palestinian child, 13-year-old Mohammed Zaid, tried to throw Molotov cocktails at the nearby Israeli settlement. And then the Israelis opened fire at him, shot him, and left him bleeding. Then the Israelis were reporting that a Palestinian was shot and killed under the bridge of Al-Jalazun refugee camp. There are walls separating the illegal settlement of Beit Il. There are towers surrounding the settlement of Beit Il with Israeli soldiers there. So it's according to the family, it's impossible for this child to go to this nearby area and to try to throw Molotov cocktails. But as usual, the Israelis try to show that it's another act by Palestinians to carry out any form of aggression against the Israelis, and that's why they opened fire. He was only 13 years old. He was the only child of his family, and he was shot and killed. This means the number of Palestinians who were killed by the Israeli forces since the 7th of October rises to 419. Palestinians were shot and killed by the Israeli forces, and a number were killed by the settlers.
Nicaragua has sued Germany at the International Court of Justice for financing Israel and for cutting aid to the UN Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA. As announced by the ICJ, the Latin American country has accused Berlin of violating international law by its continued funding for Tel Aviv. Nicaragua has asked the court to order emergency measures that would force Germany to cease military aid to Israel and to restart funding the UNRWA. Nicaragua says that Germany is facilitating the Israeli genocide against Palestinians by defunding UNRWA. Germany is a key ally of the Israeli regime and, according to UN experts, one of Tel Aviv's biggest arms providers alongside the U.S. At least the 9 UNRWA donors, including Germany and the U.S., have suspended funding for the agency. For several weeks, Israel has been the scene of protests against the policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We discussed this with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
And now it's time for the news review section, where we delve deeper into the day's one of the day's top stories. So stay with us. Now, thousands of Israeli protesters have rallied in Tel Aviv demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Several protesters were detained after clashing with the regime's forces, who used tear gas to disperse the demonstrators.
I I'm against the government which behaves like the worst fascist that ever be. They studied everything that Germany did to us. We are doing now to the Palestinians.
Protesters also called for holding snap elections. They demanded the release of Israeli captives held by Palestinian resistance groups. Also, thousands of Israelis led by the families of the captives marched to occupied Al-Quds, demanding a truce deal. Israel's premier has been under fire for putting his political interests in Gaza before the lives of the captives. Netanyahu is embroiled in a series of scandals. His charges, amongst others, include fraud and breach of trust. This has prompted protesters to take to the streets almost every weekend to call for his immediate resignation. Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Saeed Khan, Professor of Near East and Global Studies from Wayne State University from Detroit, Michigan, and also Mr. Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist from Houston, Texas. Gentlemen, welcome to the news review section. Now beginning with you, Mr. Khan, we've seen these anti-Netanyahu demos in Tel Aviv on a weekly basis. They want his resignation and are also demanding a ceasefire now, thus the release of the Israeli captives held by Palestinian resistance groups. So why is Netanyahu not listening to his own people? Many are blasting him for prioritizing his political interests in Gaza over the lives of the captives. Now, your thoughts on that. Do you think he is prolonging this onslaught because he knows he will be convicted of genocide when all this ends?
Well, I think even before a charge of genocide, there is the issue about him being convicted on several other charges that predated October the 7th, including fraud and corruption. So Netanyahu's political instincts are very much a matter of survival. And unfortunately, as we see even in the United States with some politicians, this seems to then be the main priority to even prolong something as egregious as what is going on here. I know that is a very, very cynical view to go ahead and have, but these are very extraordinary circumstances, and one has to go ahead and take a look at that in the calculus. The second thing, though, of course, is the fact that he is enabled to remain in power, not just by his own political party, but also by several Western governments. I mean, including, of course, unfortunately, the United States. The images that you're showing of the streets of Tel Aviv and the demonstrations are images that are not present within the American coverage, at least, in mainstream media, and certainly, I would argue, even more broadly in Western media. If there was a sense of seeing how unpopular he is even within his own country, that a so-called democracy has then people taking to the streets with the frequency that they are, perhaps then there would be some kind of recognition that Netanyahu, not only acting in an anti-democratic way, but acting in a way that is clearly just for his own interests and self-interest, would then evoke a different kind of reaction. But this preservation of Netanyahu and the conduct that he is perpetrating seems to be, one would argue, conspiratorial.
That's right, Mr. Naqvi, like Mr. Khan said, it seems that even Netanyahu's ally Washington is frustrated of his actions on Gaza, as the backlash has been so severe that it has also further tarnished the U.S. image, especially being the so-called advocates of human rights. Now, it's also having effects on the upcoming elections as well. As we've seen, people are now calling Biden Joe, Genocide Joe. Analysts are saying that Washington has realized this and just recently, quote, in a PR stunt, airdropped some aid to Gaza to be able to say that they went complicit in this genocide.
America's seriousness in calling for a ceasefire or to persuade the Zionist regime for a ceasefire seems more like a marketing campaign by the Biden government, because clearly the people of the U.S., the masses who have come out to protest, have made it clear that they want a permanent ceasefire in occupied Palestine. But having said that, if the U.S. was serious in pressurizing the Zionist regime, because we all know how dependent the Zionist regime is financially to the U.S., how dependent they are militarily and diplomatically throughout the world. We know that the U.S. regime is one of the only few countries that still supported the Zionist regime in the United Nations Security Council. And now recently they signed off $12 billion. Congress signed off $12 billion in military aid to the Zionist regime not too long ago. The main perpetrator in the U.S. government, apart from Biden, genocide Biden, is the Secretary of State Blinken, who seems to be one of the perpetrators of the support that the Zionist regime receives from the American government. It almost seems like a facade in which we see the likes of Blinken and other members of the Biden government who claim to want peace, who claim to want the end of the genocide in Gaza, but their actions say otherwise. And that goes on to show the vulnerability of the United States government. That goes on to show the vulnerability of the Zionist regime and its leaders, Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir, right now. Because to win this election, the Democrats and Republicans both need to take a stance on Israel. The Democrats have a softer stance, but their support is apparent. And so the hypocrisy that we see in the bipartisan political party system here in the U.S. is obvious. No matter who you are, a Democrat or a Republican, they're both one when it comes to their support for the Zionist regime. And that is because of lobby groups like AIPAC, who bear so much influence on these politicians who hold office, that to them, the American people, the U.S. citizens of the U.S. aren't as important as their relations with Netanyahu and the Zionist regime. It is because lobby groups like AIPAC fund them and support them.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Mr. Saeed Khan, Professor of Near East and Global Studies from Wayne State University, Detroit, Michigan, and also Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist from Houston, Texas. Gentlemen, thank you for your time. And with that, we come to the end of this news review section. Thank you for staying tuned.
Thousands of Austrians have taken to the streets of the capital, Vienna, to protest against the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Waving Palestinian flags, the demonstrators marched to the House of the European Union and the Parliament building. They chanted slogans including Free Palestine and Hands Off Rafah. Protesters called for an immediate ceasefire and the delivery of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's Center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders, but not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
The water that people drink.
Who's going to answer those questions? It's really important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back. So we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that, "We acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more elemental."
In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profit. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
Wasn't beautiful. You and DuPont. There's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite!
Nylon. And Teflon. The magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe that DuPont, the money means more than people.
There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. At the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city. Parkersburg. Lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you at peace, though?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant. In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose, the eye as a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong. isn't it?
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, you know, 6 to 7 years, where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
For how long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
It's a long time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take him off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, you know, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense, you know.
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, all they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. A mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around their face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this planet will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon. All of them. He said, oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men. Just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble. So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathe the fumes from them, all the samples we breathe. But we just, you know, at the time, we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for years and years, you know. And we didn't realize it. Our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. He had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostotomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with 3 other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love, seen them every day, cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement, none of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982. 34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
all employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than to do anything, they just wrote it out. I've never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lies if they would have told us there was a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We tracked down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. You go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstruction history, and you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees? Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard and the wife was watering the flowers and we got our water bill in the mail, and with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look and say, oh, okay, bang, and you put it over and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention and I started reading through it, and then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, a gentleman named Mr. Kennedy. And I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. About it was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. And he was flat out lying to me, I can tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court. After a long legal battle, the judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. They've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about 17 years, and it's about killed me a couple times. I still have thyroid problem, and I have high cholesterol. and those are all associated with CA.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostotomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I live with until I die. And there's not any hope of that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. It just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions. But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument, it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it before money. That's the only reason they continued to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh.
She lives long enough.
If I live to be 150, I'm right. There will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document, another number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview, so we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reach the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic. And you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your piece.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly.
In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
Merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another documentary. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. And this is your host, Brother Mustafa. On this show, we discuss Islamic ethics and morality and what steps we can take towards reaching God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of the most important topics that I think is extremely important in reaching God is how we utilize our time. Our time is extremely, extremely valuable, and the way we use it is, of course, going to impact our spirituality and the way we behave and how we reach Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have the very famous surah of the Quran, Surah Asr, which says, you know, God says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wal asr, innal insana lafi khusr. He swears by asr, by time, that every human being is at a loss. And one of the main losses is, of course, of time. Now, what are some practical things that we can do that can really help utilize our time? So one of the things I think we all know, for example, is scheduling our time, right? Scheduling our week. To give you an example of what I really mean, I like using this example many times. There's this famous personality on Instagram and on YouTube. He is a former American soldier. He's a commander. And you know what he does every morning? He wakes up at 4:30 and he posts a picture of his clock to show that he's woken up every morning at 4:30. And he does this every single day without any sort of, you know, breaks in his routine. He's trying to motivate people to discipline themselves and to discipline themselves to wake up every single morning. There's another very famous saying of some of these people. They say that discipline will bring you freedom, right? When you start disciplining yourself and your time, it will bring you a kind of freedom that you don't really always understand. Many times what happens is that we don't really schedule our days, and then we end up having, for example, let's say 2 to 3 hours where we don't know what to do. What do we do to fill up that time? We'll start looking at our phones, we'll start scrolling through social media, you know, we'll start watching movies and TV shows. And that's not necessarily the best use of our time. That is not necessarily going to help us to improve ourselves and to reach God. So imagine if you could schedule every single hour of your day. You would know exactly what you're doing 1 week from now, 2 weeks from now, a month from now, at every single hour. Wouldn't that make a huge difference in your life? You could set your goals that you want to achieve, and you can schedule them into your day and work on them. It's another way of reducing distractions from our life, and it allows us to truly become focused on what we want. And Islamic spirituality requires that very intense focus. It requires a very intense kind of motivation to remain consistent on this path. So there's a few steps within the step, right? There's the step of removing distractions. There's the step of remaining consistent in what we want to do. And there's a step of remaining motivated in what we want. There's a very interesting story that comes from a businessman. You know, he quotes the story. He says that you have all these kind of sort of motivational speakers that try to motivate people to be successful in their life. He says that he met one of these kind of motivational speakers and he said, you know, I really want to be successful. What should I do? What can I do? So he says, all right, you know, wake up tomorrow morning at 5 and meet me at the beach. And maybe some of you guys have heard this story before because it's quite popular, but I still find it to be a good story to repeat. So this man, he wakes up at 5 in the morning, he goes to the beach, you know, he's wearing like a suit and he's wearing a dress, and he meets this motivational speaker. The speaker tells him, you know, go and walk into the water. He goes and he says, you know, in these clothes, he says, yeah, just go walk into the water. He keeps walking and the guy says, you know, keep walking until the water reaches the person's neck. And then the person, the motivational speaker, takes his head and dips it into the sea, right? He's almost trying to drown him. And then he takes him out of the water. So this person is gasping for breath. You know, he's saying, you know, what's going on? You know, I was here to like learn how to be successful. This motivational speaker says, you know, when you were drowning, what did you want at that time? And he says, you know, of course, I wanted to breathe. I wanted air. And the speaker says that when you want success, like the way a drowning person wants air, that's when you will be successful, right? So you really, really need to want it, to be extremely motivated to reach God And when you're that motivated, you will have the motivation to discipline yourself, to schedule your life, and to make yourself better. We have to go for a quick break, and when I come back, we'll continue speaking about this. The topic that I've been speaking about, Islamic spirituality, and one of the steps towards that is utilizing our time wisely. What is the best way of using our time? As I mentioned, that we need to schedule every hour of our life. We need to know what we're doing. Now, scheduling our life isn't necessarily only related to Islamic spirituality, but it's actually a good habit for all aspects of our life. For example, if you're a student and you're studying, then you know you'll be told you need to spend, for example, a certain number of hours a day studying. This, you know, if you need to work on your health, that you can set a time, for example, exercise. And all of these actions are, in a way, worship themselves. If we do all of these things for the sake of God, if you're studying, if you're exercising, if you're spending time, you know, with our families, and even if it's time, for example, on entertainment, halal entertainment, of course, then these all become acts of worship. Studying and exercise and disciplining, these are all extremely important aspects of our lives, right? For example, if you're not exercising, then that can impact your physical health. If your physical health is impacted, then you'll have a more difficult time, for example, doing worship, doing ibadat and your prayers. It can impact your prayers. It can impact, for example, fasting. So having a really, really strong routine which involves and balances all aspects of your life is going to help you improve spiritually as well. It's not only about, for example, praying. It's not only about fasting. It's about having a well-balanced life, which where you're healthy spiritually, where you're healthy physically, and where you're healthy mentally. Let's say you look at some old politicians that are out there right now, right? You'll see that even, for example, the President of the United States, Joe Biden, if you see some of his videos, he forgets what he's saying. He forgets where he is on stage, right? He's suffering, for example, from Alzheimer's. You'll see that these people start losing their mental faculties. And not only that, you'll see that even on a physical level, they start their face and their physical, for example, demeanor starts to deteriorate. Whereas if you look at, for example, many of our scholars, you'll see that as they get older, there's a lot more grace in them. Their face becomes even more full of light. You can see that their mental faculties become even sometimes sharper. And you see that when they speak, they speak so softly and they speak so well. You don't see them forgetting, for example, things, right? You see that their memories are still very strong. Where is this power coming from, right? It's from a life of discipline. It's from a life of spending time on focusing on God and doing worship in the best manner possible. The advice that you'll always get from these people, one of the first steps, you know, towards improving yourself is to schedule your time, is to discipline yourself and have a strong routine in your life. We have a hadith, a narration from the Prophet. He says that, you know, 1 hour of thinking, of pondering can be better than, for example, 70 years of worship. So again, the emphasis is on using our time here, is using that, for example, that 1 hour to really ponder and think. This is what the Quran also tells us, you know, use your time to ponder and think about things, to correct. And it's not just about thinking about random things. It's really to think and ponder upon the signs of God. This is how we can become much closer to God and how we can correct our way of thinking and how we can also reach God and become closer to Him. So thank you so much for listening. Inshallah, please join us again on an episode of A Better Life. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows.
every shade of palm, every closed hand in us, every sparkling tear on every eyelash in us, every thought I have and every word I share in us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.